You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So, I'm Peter Reinhardt, and welcome to Pizza Quest. We're joining again today a unique kind of special edition of Pizza Quest. I'm with a longtime friend, maybe my oldest friend in the world, who is a well-known international journalist named Michael Goldfarb. Many of you will recognize the name. Those who don't, we'll get into a little bit about why he's joining us today. And what we're doing is expanding. For those of you who have been following the Pizza Quest journey, know that while many of the episodes are pizza-themed, today and in many of the upcoming episodes, our focus is going to be more on the quest than it is on the pizza. And Michael, as a, I would say, a true quester, and that's what I want to find out about, is what is it that has been driving your search, your quest for meaning? Because, and just as a, for quick background, and I think we'll fill in the gaps as we talk, but Michael is an expat. He's living over in Great Britain, has been in London for at least, 30-some years. And when we were kids, I'll just sort of preface it by saying, when we were kids, even way back, you used to tell me, I'm gonna leave this country. I'm gonna live somewhere else someday. And I didn't know how serious to take that. You and I went to England together as high school students, and while we were there, I don't know if something happened there that clicked, that maybe that indicated to you that this might be the place. But then over the years, we've each had our separate journeys and reconnected and stayed in touch. And why don't you fill in the gaps? Biographical note for everyone. Michael is the host, the current host of the FRDH podcast. And we can start by explaining what that is, and then we'll go back and catch up on how we got to FRDH.
Okay. It's a very long journey, Peter, because neither of us is very young anymore. FRDH stands for First Rough Draft of History. And journalists, we flatter ourselves to think that we are writing the first rough draft of history. And in some ways, yeah, because if you want to know what happened, on such and such a day in 1981, you check the paper and you say, oh, on this day, yeah, Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. Oh, it's a big deal. It's a big change in American history. What did the paper say about it? It isn't necessarily deep history. It's just the first rough draft. So anyway, I had a career in journalism that stretches back to 1981. Just before Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, I started a job as a copy aide at the Washington Post. And I'm still doing journalism. I still make documentaries for the BBC. So I started this podcast, to look back at events that are still going on, but that I covered. We're upcoming on the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War. I was in Iraq, an unembedded reporter during that war.
And you wrote a book about that, I know. Yeah. But and I always wonder, what does that mean, unembedded? For those of us who are,
it meant that I was operating on my own. Most people had to go in with the U.S. or the British military. And once you're under their umbrella. It's more than an umbrella. You go where they go, you see what they want you to see, and it's tough to practice journalism. I was unembedded, which is slightly riskier, in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish part of Iraq. And so I was free to go wherever I wanted to, that wouldn't get me killed, and see what was happening.
And were you broadcasting from there? Were you sending?
I did. I went there. My original assignment was to follow the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, because there's no doubt he was going to get overthrown, and follow it through the eyes of an Iraqi who had suffered under Saddam Hussein. Now, I had gone to Iraqi Kurdistan in the late 90s for NPR, when I was the NPR London correspondent, and I knew it wouldn't be a great deal of difficulty to find someone who suffered under Saddam, because all the Kurds suffered under Saddam.
Yeah.
And I just lucked into, the night before the war started, a guy who spoke reasonable English, who had been arrested and tortured several times for his political activity, his anti-regime activity. And he was looking for a job as a translator. So I hired him, and I interviewed him, and he interviewed me. He's the same age as you and I, Doug, Peter.
We can let everyone know our names have changed. My name has changed for a while. All of a sudden, I was reading about a guy named Michael Govan, who was acting
was
in New York City, and my name initially, as we were kids, I was known as Doug, and now later it became Peter.
You talk about quests. I mean, here we are. We are two, nice guys from the same Jewish suburb of Philadelphia, and
yet
we have spent our whole lives, in a sense, trying to get away. Not everybody we grew up with did want that.
That's right.
They were happy to stay and live life and live good lives, I have to say. I mean, I might have said, oh, come on, don't you want to do more with your life? But now, you get to a certain age, you think, well, you did it your way and I'm doing it my way.
Right.
But it's interesting that you and I, we were best friends, and there you are in North Carolina, and you've got a different name, and your life path is always an amazing thing to me.
Every time we would reconnect over the years, we would have to catch up on where the journey has taken us.
Yeah. So anyway, in Iraq, to go back to Iraq, I was unembedded, and Ahmed, my friend, and I roamed around northern Iraq. There wasn't a lot of fighting there. And then at the very end of the war, after the U.S. troops had got to Baghdad, the regime simply collapsed in northern Iraq, and what was left of the Iraqi army literally walked away. I mean, they just took off their uniforms and walked home. Right? They weren't interested in dying for a regime that had already collapsed. And we went to Mosul, which is where Ahmed was actually from. And that's where we saw some very, very interesting stuff. Anyway, my friend, we became friends, had been a journalist. And after the war was over, through my help, I didn't intend it this way, he got hooked up with the American occupying force, and they gave him money to start a newspaper, a pro-democracy newspaper. And it was like an amazing thing. He had been arrested and tortured at least three times. And here he was, he'd outlived the regime, and he was free to write whatever he wanted. And he got 11 issues out, and he got shot in the back, assassinated. And I wrote a book about that and the bitter irony of living so long, only to be murdered in the chaos that followed.
It's an amazing book. And of course, I read it. It's called, for those of you who should go out and get this book, it's called Ahmed's War, Ahmed's Peace. Correct? Am I saying
right?
That was the title? And this was you have a few books more than that one, but that one was the one that kind of was internationally timely at the time. Who assassinated him? Was he assassinated by
do you know
locals, by dissidents?
It was all of the forces that the regime was overthrown, but the really dark forces that the regime had unleashed over 20 years remained in place. And he was writing about this. He could see it. There were Ba'ath regime loyalists, and they had when there was a period in his life when he was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And so he knew a lot of radical Islamists, and he knew them on sight, and he could see them, and he saw that they were now forming little groups, little cells to combat the American troops who had settled in Mosul as part of the occupation. And he wrote, he probably shouldn't have written as he did. And they told, you know, they made no bones that they were going to get him. And they got him.
So they kind of viewed him as like an American collaborator. So
yes, they did. Exactly.
Because he did work with and support you through that, and you supported him. So I guess they viewed him as being on whatever, that side of the fence.
That, well, you know, it's a sad thing. I mean, you can't bring democracy to people at the point of a gun. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, in the end, it's just, on the other hand, you say, well, if you let people rot under a dictator, I don't know. It's a conundrum I still haven't figured out.
Yeah,
anyway,
no, it's a tough one. But this is really one of many adventures as a journalist that you took on. I mean, this was after a long, distinguished career working for NPR. You were a bureau chief. You did a series of radio documentaries that won all sorts of awards. You won Edward R. Merrow Award. There was the big one in Britain that you won, the Sony Award. Yeah. So you've done, you know, all different kinds of things. You've been written journalism, audio, you know, journalism. But you didn't, you know, how did that all unfold for you? And why did you end up in England? You know, knowing that I know, and I'm going to say,
okay. All right. So now we're going to,
we're on our own diaspora.
Okay. All right. So let's entertain the listeners, Peter. So the summer when you were 17, I hadn't quite turned 17 yet. And we went to this summer school in the north of England at the University of Durham.
Durham.
A beautiful town. What possibly the prettiest town in England, and far enough off the tourist trail that it rarely gets overrun. It's got this gorgeous Norman cathedral sitting on top of a bluff overlooking a river. And
there's a
university town. That's where we were studying. And I don't know, that place just connected to me.
Yeah.
Partially, I mean, I think it's, you know, I was a moody adolescent. And until you've seen the skies over the north of England and Scotland, you can't imagine how moody skies can be. Because unlike in North America, the clouds are only about 700 or 800 feet off the deck. When you look up into the clouds look like they're about to hit you in the head.
Uh-huh.
It's not like, you know, a cloudy day.
Yeah.
Where the clouds are at 10,000 feet. And I just, I don't know, it spoke to where my soul was at that moment in my life.
So something
and I really
did happen
up
for you on that trip. I mean, we had fun adventures, and I learned how to play rugby then. I didn't,
you heard
we
did, that.
We had fun stuff that happened, but something happened differently for you than for me. For me, I loved it, but I didn't think I'm going to land here.
Yeah. It was just something I felt it almost instantly. And you know, and the other thing, to be honest, is they use the English language a little differently over here.
Mm-hmm.
And it fit the way I use it. They got my humor. They're incredibly ironic. And half your conversations you spend wondering, is he serious? Is she serious? And they're sarky. And as you know, I was voted the most cynical member of the class of 1968.
I know. So, yeah. I wanted to speak that, because in high school you had a love-hate relationship with our class, with our classmates, because you not only were voted most cynical and I think in some polls the most obnoxious kid in the school, and at the same time you were chosen by your classmates to give the graduation speech because they all wanted to hear what you had to say on our last day of school. And a few years later the movie Broadcast News came out. And I think of you every time I see this movie, because there's a scene where the Albert Brooks character is giving his high school graduation speech, And he tells all the students, you know, something he chews them out, and then he tells them, "I forgive you." But and then three tough guys come out and beat him up, right? And he says, "You can hit me now, but I'm going to see the whole world, and you'll never make more than $25,000 a year." And the kids was going, $25,000 a year? That's not bad, you know. But he's "I'm going to see the world," and that's what kind of happened. You saw the world.
I split the difference. I've seen the world, but I only make. A year. It's weird. I guess even then I knew that I needed to go away. I really did need to go away. It was something, an urge that I felt. And I've written about this. One of the best things that's happened is when I moved over here in 1985, so I've actually lived in Britain longer than I lived in the US, although you wouldn't know it from my accent. I mean, they won't let you. The Brits simply will not let you adapt their accent. They will mock you till it's just horrible.
You'll never be one of us.
And it's true. I never will be. Although, you know, I'm sort of an honorary Brit. And but the nice thing is, because the NPR Bureau was in the building that houses the BBC World Service, which is often heard on NPR stations overnight, I got to know people, and they started sending me back periodically, go somewhere in America, see what's changed. And I did that throughout the 1990s. I got to see the part of the Midwest where I went to university. I drove along the border from Yuma to El Paso, which was really eye-opening.
Yeah.
And I also went around Mississippi, a state that, you know, I don't, you know, had a certain fear about it. You know, it's not a place that has a bad reputation. I went down there and I decided I really liked the place, in spite of all of its terrible history. And then in more recent years, I've been able to write about growing up in America in the 50s and 60s and what life was like before, just before we entered the adult world and our quests.
Yes.
And I've come to the conclusion that, you know, part of my desire to move on, you know, I was born in New York City, and we moved to the suburbs of Philadelphia, to the same street you lived on, when I was 8. And it's just a critical age. You know, you move, why do you move? Because my father's job changed. He got offered a position at a medical school. He took it. My younger siblings have no memory of New York. You know, had no impact on them. But I was already a settled New Yorker in terms of what my interests were.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to Philadelphia, it's the suburbs, and I'm used to living on 90th Street near Lexington Avenue. I don't know what grass is. I mean, other than walking into Central Park, I don't know what it is to have a lawn. I don't know, you know, what woods out the back. What I didn't know. I just couldn't function. And I think that has a lot to do with my desire to keep moving.
Interesting.
Want to keep moving.
Yeah, because there was this sense of fish out of water, little, you know, there was always something burning inside of you that made you, maybe to some people, appear angry or not at peace with where you were at and always looking for something else. And that's kind of, and when we come back after the break, that's what everyone explores. What is it, you know, that's driving you then and driving you still even now, because you're still living the journalist life. And you're writing your current book is History of a Calamity, which is, seems like this is more your autobiographical recap of history in terms of your own life. And you talk a lot about your growing up in New York and moved in, you know, all the places you've lived. I think what's the subtitle? It's a Hack's Life. So I want to talk about that a little bit more, too, when we come back, because of all my friends, you were the most restless, I think, most restless spirit of us all. And nobody knew how it was going to end, where it was going to lead you, but we knew you were going to go somewhere and in search of it. And that's what I'd love to hear you know, your take on what it is that you've been searching for and how you've been finding it. So join us back for part two. We're going to take a little break now, come back for part two. We'll continue with Michael Goldfarb. I want to hear about a little bit more about these documentaries that you did. I know that you did the one where you traveled through the South, but you've reported on political situations. There's one of your documentaries that I listened to many times when it first aired on WBUR in Boston was it The Jews and the Blues?
Jews and the Blues.
And that was so anyway, you've done a lot of really cool stuff. Come back on part two with Michael Goldfarb and we'll hear more about his quest for, well, we'll find out, a quest for what. We're back with Michael Goldfarb and we're talking about quest today, and we'll slip a little pizza in there at the end, but we want to continue where we left off, Michael, where you know, we're talking about sort of this restless search for something. You know, I always felt like those of us who did leave are where we were grew up, where we were nurtured and went searching for something else. We had to be looking for something. We didn't always know what it was. We maybe couldn't articulate it, but we knew that we weren't finding it where we were. And we felt like we had to go out, almost like I felt like we were in our own diaspora. And you, one of your other books, we mentioned your first book and we mentioned your current book, but then in between you wrote a book called Emancipation, the subtitle, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. And, you know, again, that was sort of like the modern diaspora of the Jewish people. But on a personal level, I always felt like I was in my own diaspora trying to find my true home and get back to my home. And I don't know if that resonates with you at all, but I feel like searches.
It's interesting, Peter, because you've always, not always, but once we went off to college, you immediately gravitated towards a faith search. And your framework for looking and describing the world is the way you framed that question to me. And I don't approach it that way. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, one of the things people should understand, look, we came up in a very comfortable upper middle class suburb of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And in another time and era, we might well have said, why question the advantages? You know, just keep your nose clean, do well enough. You had a bit, you know, you could have gone into your father's business, for example.
Yes.
Or sure. You could have become a professional man, any profession you wanted. You're a bright guy. Me too. I mean, if I'd wanted to, if I could stand the sight of blood and urine and all kinds of bodily extrusions, I could have become a doctor like my father.
Right.
But I didn't want that. And it was also, let's face it, it was the 1960s. And I think, you know, one of the things that really fries my butt is discourse about baby boomers. Because you know, and I know, that this idea that over an 18-year period, people who were born all have the same worldview is garbage. I think that if you were born particularly between 1948 and 1952, mm-hmm. so that, you know, you came of age, you're 15 years old, people are getting 18 years old, people are getting murdered. The leaders are getting murdered mm-hmm. around you. You know, a few nights before we graduated high school, Bobby Kennedy was shot. Two months before that, Martin Luther King had been shot.
Yes.
I think it made more of us people in that cohort, that small, narrow slice of what's called the baby boom, inclined to move on. Mm-hmm. There was something that we probably at the age of 17 or 18 couldn't articulate about what was going wrong in the country. But knowing and having an understanding that whatever it was, you don't go around shooting the leaders. I mean, this is just, or having riots every summer. I mean, you just don't, this is not right. Anyway, so I did feel like I wanted to keep moving. And, you know, I went to, you know, and it took me a long time to get to journalism, I have to say. I mean, it was so easy for me. You know, here we go. We'll talk more about our joined past. You know, you were the editor of the high school paper. Right. I was the features editor of the high school paper. And it worked great for because all I could do, I just wrote columns. I didn't work, you know, I can write whatever I like.
Yeah.
It was great. You know, you can edit, you can have the title. I don't care. And I just want to write and say what's on my mind.
And in fact, while we did the newspaper, which was the formal newspaper, we also did an underground newspaper together with a few of our other friends. And we would sneak into the mimeograph room and print off copies of an underground paper that we'd sell for 10 cents a copy or something. And so we were troublemakers while we were also kind of like trying to toe the line.
Exactly. And I, you know, I went the summer after we graduated, I worked at the local public radio station. NPR hadn't formed yet. It was just lots of individual public radio stations. That station today is WHYY in Philadelphia, one of the big stations.
Yeah.
And I, you know, you could do those things in those days. Oh, I'll try this. I'll try that. No, you know, it wasn't a struggle. You didn't have to be a nepo. You know, you could just go out and do what you wanted. And then I walked away from it. And I didn't go back till I was 30. I walked away from it in a large part because it was very easy for me. I was really good at it. I knew that. I was a good writer. I was good at the basics of reporting because I like to, you know, I like to observe. And so I was about 10 years late starting my career. I didn't really start till I was 30. And that's why, you know, I'm still doing it. And I do it because I've been lucky in that I didn't have a single beat. I could move on. I mean, sometimes I didn't want to move on. Sometimes I wanted to stay with the story. But if the boss man tells you, or the boss woman, actually, says, no, you got to go do this story now, then you have to go and do it.
Yeah.
But I saw an awful lot. And I lucked into my career in public radio because I took the risk of moving to London with no strings attached. And I knew from my time there as a, you know, I did a year abroad there after we had been over there in the summer. I went back and did a junior year abroad. And I knew that Fleet Street, where the British newspapers are headquartered, have a lot of freelance work. This is not the case in America. You know, what you see in the New York Times or in the Washington Post or even your local paper, the Charlotte Observer, on any given day, almost all of it is produced by staffers, staff reporters, staff editors. In Britain, it's maybe half the paper.
Really?
So there's a lot of opportunity to, you know, and you can sort of keep yourself afloat. Freelancing. And I started doing that. And because I was, you know, I have a nice voice and I like to work with sound. I just like it. It's a medium I'm happy with. I found my way into radio and as an arts reporter. And then I got into hard news by chance and found I loved it. I love being on Deadline. I just loved it. And I loved being in hair-raising situations. It suddenly, I wasn't the guy who climbed to the highest branch of a tree when I was a kid, but I found that being in the middle of a riot, that going into war zones focused me and, you know, watching history, you know, the real, you know, looking, it's like looking into the fire from up close
and
seeing, you know, where the yellow flame becomes orange, becomes blue. You could just see that and then report it out very quickly and accurately. I found it thrilling and I just stayed with it.
Did you find it meaningful in a way that other things prior to that? I mean, during that in-between time from college till you ended up back in journalism, you were doing theater. You were in New York trying to make it as an actor. I know you were in a Broadway show at one time. You were doing a lot of different self-discovery kind of things, but performing was always something you enjoyed doing. From our youngest days, you were always performing in plays and things. Maybe that's where that voice came from, because even now when my current friends find out that I know you, they go, did he always have that voice?
That's the first question. Only in front of a microphone. No, I always had a nice voice. I don't know why. I mean, I people say, used to say to me, you don't sound like you're from New York. I said, well, no, because, you know, I'm from that first generation of people who grew up you know, you listen to Walter Cronkite and Huntley, not Brinkley, because he had a North Carolina accent, but you know, that stentorian sound was part of the background. In fact, in the next chapter of the online book that I'm writing about Paul Harvey. Do you remember Paul Harvey?
Sure, Paul Harvey. Yeah,
the rest. You know, I'm just writing about, you know, how. I mean, if there's an emphasis, this is a very conservative Christian guy, and I used to love listening to him. He would be driving around the suburbs doing shopping with my mother, you know, and he'd pop up on the radio for his 3-minute daily broadcast, and you think, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, he had that incredibly powerful voice. Something like time stops when he's on because you want to hear what he has to say.
And he had all these quirks, and he got away with the quirks. And now, I mean, we don't have time in this podcast, but I mean, he was his own boss. I mean, people took him for the quirks. He sold he syndicated himself. He didn't work with a syndicator. He started out by going around saying, this is what I do. And these small stations in Indiana and Illinois would say, we like that, and we'll take you at noon. And when he had enough, then he got rich. And I'm hoping someday my podcast will do the same for
you,
but I'm not sure.
Yeah, because he was basically doing podcasting before there was podcasting.
It's podcasting is just a delivery medium.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what Paul Harvey, he is as close to the original as you can have. Between blogging and podcasting, that's who he was. Anyway, so I did all these things, and in terms of Quest, the years in New York, the 1970s, that was having stepped away from our comfortable background in the suburbs. I finally got back to New York, which is something I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I simply, and it was great because I did my first kind of courageous thing that satisfied me. Uh-huh. And I drove a cab on the night shift for a couple of years in mid-1970s New York, which is remembered now as the city is burning, and it was very dangerous, and it was. I mean, I can't say it wasn't. And I went anywhere and everywhere. I mean, somebody says, take me into the Bronx, when the Bronx really was a kind of war zone. You know, it's almost impossible, unless you live through it, to imagine that in the center of Western culture and, you know, business, New York City, that the city turned its back and allowed several hundred acres of, you know, one of its boroughs to be burned to the ground with no care for where the people who lived in the houses that were destroyed went. And this was a time when, you know, when I was born in 1950, the city's population was over 8 million. By the time I stopped driving a cab, it was a little under 7 million. And nobody ever figured out where those million people went.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was, and if I had been a, anyway, I worked my way through all that stuff, and I realized I loved acting and I loved going on the stage. I'm just going to sound really pompous, but I realized I had more in me. There was more for me to do.
Yeah.
I could have done small parts because I wasn't doing big parts. I was working professionally, but you know, I wasn't going to play Hamlet. And I wasn't even going to be Albert Brooks, who was having my fucking, Albert Brooks.
We're not on network.
You know, Albert Brooks in broadcast news was having my career. That's my life.
He was living
my life. And in fact, the reason I don't work in television is that I sweat under the lights.
Just like Albert Brooks.
Just like Albert. And also because, look, you know, what happened was, you know, there was a time when a guy like Dustin Hoffman or Gene Hackman could be the top grossing film star in America, and they are not handsome men, and they are not leading men in the Rock Hudson, Burt Lancaster mold.
Right.
Similarly, there was a time, a brief time, when a serious guy could be a network anchor. But in the end, you have to look like William Hurt. And I mean William Hurt before he got fat and bald in his old age.
Well, that movie was just so great because it was so full of truths, you know, reality truths that, you know, that told a story that I know I could relate to it. And hearing you recap it now, that's one of the reasons why it's probably one of my top 20 all-time films.
Yeah. So anyway, I'll tell you this one story and then I'll stop name dropping. So I was in a play at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, and it was a British play, American premiere. The thought was it was going to go to Broadway after a tryout in New Haven. Mm-hmm. And I was dressing next to Kevin Bacon, and because it was just one dressing room for men, and two things down from Kevin was a guy named Peter Friedman, who's in Succession now. He's been around for a long time. And two doors down from him was J.T. Walsh, who died too young. Yeah. But was in the 80s and 90s, he was the villain of choice in most Hollywood movies. He's a fantastic, fantastically intelligent guy. And on the other side of the wall, the star of the play was Dame Eileen Atkins. And I was dressing with them, and I think, you know what? They are so much better than I am. And I'm pretty good, but I don't have what they have. Mm. And I think I'm here on Earth to do something more. And one day I was talking to JT, who had just understudied Al Pacino in Richard III. Al Pacino did Richard III on Broadway, and the critics panned it, and the place was sold out for 2 months. Every Italian kid within 500 miles of New York City wanted the one and only Shakespeare they ever saw was Al Pacino playing Richard III. And JT understudied him. He never went on. But he got to know him a bit, and they physically were completely different and whatever. And I asked JT, so what's Al Pacino really like? And he said, if he hadn't had acting, he'd have been a murderer.
Interesting.
And it was an interesting comment because I understood something about myself out of it, which is Al Pacino had nothing. I mean, and he's been open about his own background. You know, he's raised by a single mother. His father was a petty criminal, rough guy. He really had nothing. Mm. You know, he didn't do, you know, he wasn't a scholar or anything. And he found his way to acting, and it saved his life. I had other things that I could do, other things I might even be better at. Mm-hmm. So I went back to journalism and also, I wanted to leave the country. So when I met my wife, Kristen, she had a British passport, and we decided to give London a try, open-ended. And as I suspected, I was able to start working right away. And, you know, I worked really hard. And in about 5 years, I had established myself, and, you know, I'm still working because I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of like you found your landing place. You found your port of call, which I think that everyone is searching for, whether it's coming back home and settling back where you grew up or moving on and landing somewhere else. I think everyone has a yearning deep inside to find the place where I fit and I can fulfill whatever is left in me, you know, to fulfill, to find a sense of purpose and meaning, which it seems like you found much more peace of mind being, even though you're still out there doing adventures, that there was something, an internal peace that kind of animates you as well.
Mm.
So, although I remember when we visited you in London, when Susan and I came to London, and you gave us your London by night tour, driving us around London because you said it would be impossible to see anything during the day with all the traffic. One of the scariest rides we've ever had is the London by night tour with you.
Oh, come on.
because it's still, you know, it's some kind of a fire burning in you. And that's kind of why I really wanted to have you come, you know, on our podcast is to talk about that fire.
Well, You know, you can't do that tour anymore. There's so many traffic restrictions.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not.
Well, it's been a while since we were there with you. You know.
I know. You can't do that. Also, when we moved here, the city, the population was down to about 6.5 million. Now it's somewhere over 9 million. And on any given day, there's about 1 million tourists. It's crowded in a way that I find really unpleasant. But I don't have to go out in it every day.
But I can say this. When we visited you back then, and we're talking, you know, back in eight, we were there in 89 because I remember because that's when the San Francisco earthquake happened. While we were in England visiting you, mm-hmm. the earthquake took place in San Francisco where we were living at the time. And back then, the food scene in London was, other than Indian food, it was kind of like it was a wasteland. It was a joke. And now London seems to be one of the, you know, real food meccas of the world. There's something
it is a huge change, one that's pretty well established. I did a story for NPR in 1997 about the huge change, and I spent time in a kitchen with an up-and-coming chef named Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, right.
Who hadn't even graduated to having he had his own restaurant, but it wasn't called Gordon Ramsay because he wasn't a brand name yet, and he hadn't gone on to become I wish he hadn't. He was really good in the kitchen, but he's decided to become an internationally famous, I won't say a bad word, curmudgeon of the kitchen. You know, he's going to abuse
you. He's
become
a character based on Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, and he's become very wealthy doing it, so good for him.
Was he at that time still working under Marco Pierre White? Were you familiar?
No, this was his first place. Uh-huh. And he left Marco Pierre White, and I mean, they had been apprenticed together, and Marco Pierre White became famous before he did. He was working for Marco Pierre White, and then he left Marco Pierre White, and there was the typical kind of breakup blues about, it was like a rock band, you know.
Yeah.
You can't go off and be a solo star. I made you. Yeah, well, I can. And he went off and he
but those were
a
like the
star.
Bad boys of the kitchen. They
happened is Marco Pierre White. Was not as anywhere near as good a businessman, and he went bust, and he's back in it now, but in a very minor way, whereas Gordon Ramsay has his empire, and he doesn't cook anymore, so far as I can tell. He doesn't cook in any of his restaurants.
No, just on TV. But
he oversees the head chefs, and if you know, and he just, they all leave him and start their own restaurants, and some leave him under nice circumstances, and some say, you know, I can't put up with your
right anymore. Well, but one of the other things that changed, so the whole London food scene changed. There was the River Cafe. There was all sorts of really cool food things happening. Jamie Oliver, you know, emerged as a very important television chef, you know, and is a good cook. But then I noticed that the pizza scene kind of took off over the last few years, and London is now a very hot pizza city. Did you see any of that happening? Have you been to any really cool pizza places?
Well, yeah, I tell you, the Neapolitan place that claims to be the first, called Da Michele,
in Naples.
In Naples, opened its first London branch down the street from where I live. And a friend of mine who does occasional food reviewing for magazines said, I need someone to come as my plus one. You want to come? And when it was very good. It wasn't quite the same as having a good, you know, charred on the bottom slice of Neapolitan pizza in Italy. But, you know, a funny story. When we got married, my wife and I said, look, we're moving. Don't give us objects. We're moving to England. Cash is much better than heavy stuff that we probably won't bring over with us.
Yeah.
And people were generous. You know, you get married, you say, all right, fine. So we moved over, and we were thinking, well, you know, what do we do? Because we had a small nest egg. And I mean, it was small. And one of the things we had noticed on our one and only reconnaissance trip was there was no pizza. And, you know, how can you have a city with no pizza? I lived on pizza in New York. I really did live, especially when I was an actor, because where else are you going to get full?
Right.
In those days for 75 cents.
So New York, that you could survive on pizza at least. Yeah.
So we did some research and we found you had to go to Italy to get an oven. And we looked at renting and we thought about, or it wasn't that serious, buying a pizza oven in, you know, a Bari pizza oven in Bari, you know, way down at the south of Italy, hiring, you know, a little van with a hitch on it, hitching it up, bringing it up, renting a premises, and starting to have a pizza place called The Slice. And it was going to be open late because London wasn't open late in those days because pubs closed at 11 o'clock. You know, it was called, we had our advertising campaign together, The Slice. You get hungry when you get hungry. We are open when you get hungry. And we would sell pizza by the slice because there were one or two places, but you got a whole pie. And,
yeah.
And that's too much. Right? I want a slice of pizza.
Yeah.
And you know, my wife told me I had to hit the weight room a bit more so I would look, you know, when I put on my tank right. top, I had proper, you know, Harvey Keitel and Mean Street kind of body, you know. And Peter, you know I don't have that body. So anyway,
but not too many pizza guys do either.
So anyway, we never did it. Obviously, there were it was just too much, and
path not taken.
I wanted to get established, but it was a little dream.
Well, and interesting
now,
that you
now
said
you can
that.
Have the pizza, but I don't like it much. I find it's I've been lucky, you know, I've been able to get to Italy a lot, and it's not as good as, frankly, the pizza of my memory, which is the
yeah.
pizza which you and I grew yeah. up eating from Mama's on Belmont Avenue and in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And it's not the thing for me that it once was.
Yeah,
we eat it if we're lucky enough to get to Italy for a bit of R&R. Of course you have pizza, but otherwise, no.
But it's interesting that you flirted with that idea, which was, again, 40 years before everybody else started coming up with that idea, because now everybody's doing that. There are a couple of Brits that we had on Pizza Quest who went over and bought a little oven and hooked it onto a three-wheeler and brought it back to London. They have a place now that has a few locations called the Pizza Pilgrims. I don't know if you've run across them.
But, I have.
They followed your script, but they actually did it.
Yeah, see, well, you know, it's we were probably a little bit before time. I mean, nowadays it's a not uncommon thing for people to come up with an idea, come up with a concept, try, you know, if they're ambitious, they'll take a premises, they'll do it. But the goal is always to score some private equity money so they can expound.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's a concept, right?
Right.
That wasn't it. I think I would, you know, it wouldn't have worked. It wasn't me. It would have been Kristen's thing to do. And frankly, it wasn't her either.
Yeah.
But it was as an idea for making money and also providing a public service, because in London, you just can't find a decent slice of pizza.
And
a city without a decent slice of pizza. Come on, it's terrible.
Well, that shows you how times have changed, because now you probably can find a decent slice of pizza at a lot of places throughout London, I would think. I remember back when we were in college, I was in Boston at that time, you know, we flirted with the idea of opening a cheesesteak place because we couldn't find a good cheesesteak sandwich in Boston. And we thought everyone's going to love cheesesteaks the way they do in Philadelphia. It doesn't work that way, though, a lot of times.
Well, not between, no, in Boston, they would never eat a Philadelphia cheesesteak.
That's right.
It's just Boston. Anywhere else, I mean, in New York, they'll buy a Philadelphia cheesesteak. But not Boston, and especially not 1969 when the Sixers and the Celtics had a real rivalry.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'll tell you, I'd love to spend another whole hour. We'd love to have you come back another time and catch, because we're just scratching the surface of me catching up with you again. And I'm hearing, even after all these years of knowing you, new stories that I didn't even know, you know, that you lived, adventures that you had, that when we were miles apart, and I love hearing them. You're doing this sort of serialized book The History of a Calamity, which is coming out in chapters, right? So if people want to, if they want to tune into that, what's the best way for them to be able to log in?
If you go to Substack, look up History of a Calamity. It's an that's a name you won't forget. The calamity is America's calamity. How did we get to, how did you go from the 1950s when you and I were children and end up where we ended up? That it happened in a single lifetime, and I accept that we're not young, but geez, this is, there's one section that's out there already that starts, when was the war? It was the Vietnam War. But I mean, the kinds of changes that you see in America now from where we were as children, you think there had to have been a war or a Great Depression. We didn't have that. And yet we've ended up in this place. And it's a bit of memoir. It's also a bit of real history writing and reporting, because that's what I do.
Yeah, because it's a really nice weave of history and your own personal journey. It's enjoyable to read.
We're all actors in history, one way or another, and I may be a bit more obsessive than others about thinking, geez, it's like my whole life is a series of where were you when Kennedy was shot moments. But that's the impetus. This stuff, big stuff happening above us. But how does it impact on you? Did it make a difference to you? Did it change your life? Why did it happen? Or did something you've just realized, this happened to me 20 years ago. Oh, it happened because this was going on in the wider world, but I just didn't know about it.
Yeah, and I love how you, when you're telling that story, you provide a context that gives that gives you a sense of understanding it in a whole new way. As you do, each of us bring our own personal, where were we at that moment to the bigger picture that we may not have known about. So I really think that's a great service, in reading your work. And that's what I loved about your book, Emancipation. And it's a book that I highly, I think every Jewish person, not only in this country, but anywhere, should read that book, because it really tells the story, of essentially the Jewish community for the last 1,000 years and especially up into the, Holocaust and then beyond, but where we are now, and the subtitle, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. That's a book that I highly recommend, but I don't think you have to be Jewish to auto read that book, because it's a history book as well. So I think that's a book that, again, I think all of your books have been really well written, beautifully told stories, and a lot of people don't know about them yet. So hopefully anyone who's listening here, the best way is, again, look up Michael Goldfarb on Amazon, or go to your Wikipedia page or whatever, and get the link to those things. And then, of course, the ongoing FRDH. How do people sign up to get the feed for that?
You can go to, this is an easy URL, goldfarbpod.com.
There you go.
And it's there, or it streams at SoundCloud, Apple, at all the best distribution points.
And they're terrific, because you interview a lot of really interesting, important people. You also do commentaries. They're short form, so that it's not like this, which is like a 45-minute show. Your episodes are typically about 10 to 20 minutes long, and it's a good bite of engagement. So I recommend anybody who's listening to us today, make sure that you're getting the FRDH podcast as well. So Michael, thank you so much for giving us your time today and sharing stories, and we got more stories to catch up with. We'll get you back
next time. Peter, it's always great to see you, man.
It's been a long time in person, but now we've got another bridge, another way to connect.
Exactly.
Thank all of you for joining us. We'll see you at the next episode of Pizza Quest.
Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.